Hello to all the dogs, canines, canids, eating dogs, hungry dogs, famished dogs, starving dogs. You're listening to the Dear Daniel podcast. I'm Corky McDonald, local comedian, and I've got just one last job to do. If this goes right, I am set for life on a beach in the Bahamas, baby. And with me, as always, is my co-host, film critic, Daniel Barnes.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dare Daniel, Cage Match. Over the course of this season, what a blast it's been. We've been exploring the cinema of Mr. Nicolas Cage, the terrifying nooks, the disturbing crannies, and that delicious toasty crunch that you only get from the great Mr. Cage, and it's all for your sick and twisted amusement, of course.
This week, for your sick and twisted amusement, we're reviewing Cage and Willem Dafoe as kidnappers and Paul Schrader's straight-to-VOD film, Dog Eat Dog. The IMDb synopsis for Dog Eat Dog? A crew of ex-cons are hired by a Cleveland mafioso to kidnap the baby of a rival mobster.
Yes, it's Dog Eat Dog. Directed by the great Paul Schrader during kind of a weird time in his career. I mean, when wasn't there a weird time in his career? He was always a notorious character, and still these many years later, he's always good for an offensive soundbite and the occasional masterpiece. I mean, he came out, you could talk in 70s and 80s, this dude was Dave fucking Kingman over here. This dude was tape measure home runs, you know, or it was big doubles into the gap, you know what I mean? He was just cranking them out. He wrote fucking Taxi Driver, co-wrote Raging Bull, and wrote Obsession, Last Temptation of the Christ. He directed Blue Collar and Hardcore, American Gigolo, Cat People, Mishima, Patty Hearst, Light Sleeper. I mean, just killing it. But, you know, in 90s and the 2000s, you're up, you're down, you're hitting, you're missing. And this was kind of a rough point in his career. He had done the prequel to The Exorcist. Yeah,
you're up, you're down, you're getting fired off jobs that get totally redirected.
By Rennie Harlan, no less. Made some real bad movies, made the one with Lindsay Lohan, The Canyons. And then right before this one, he actually made another Nick Cage movie, Dying of the Light, which we'll talk about that in a second. Screenplay here, it's by Matthew Wilder, adapted from the pulp novel by infamous crime writer Eddie Bunker. Of course, if you know the movie Straight Time with Dustin Hoffman, that's based on an Eddie Bunker novel. He was a criminal. He was a career criminal from like childhood. From a little boy, he was a criminal and became a great writer. Of course, he was Mr. Blue in Reservoir Dogs. He wrote Animal Factory, which became a film. So we got some bona fides here, a little bit, I guess. I don't really know that much about his writing. Of course, Dog Eat Dog does star our man of the season, Nicolas Cage. He's not the man for all seasons, of course. That's still Sir Thomas More. Okay, we're not. Let's not. Listen, I don't care how many dinosaurs you step on. We are not. I will not allow this to be rewritten, okay? The man for all seasons is Sir Thomas More. And the man for our season, well, it's Nick Cage, of course. Also, Car stars Willem Dafoe, who I consider more Willem Dafriend, Christopher Matthew Cook, and Paul Schrader himself in a role. Like I said, second film in a row that Schrader made with Cage, because the first one was such a roaring success. No, their previous effort, 2014 film Dying of the Light, was also taken away by the producers. It was recut, and both Schrader and Cage disavowed the final project. Schrader actually said that he made Dog Eat Dog in part to redeem himself with Cage, to say, like, hey, you know, we can make a movie together, and it doesn't have to be a complete and total fucking nightmare. Principal photography took place in Cleveland and other locations in Ohio. But man, you're not going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. There's nothing recognizably Cleveland in this movie. It's a dirty, dirty, nasty movie. Debuted as the closing film in the Director's Fortnight section at the 2016 Cannes Film Festival. Only received a VOD release back home in America on November 4, 2016. Grossed a little under $200,000 in various other countries against a budget of who knows, but not much. 50 on Rotten Tomato. Audience score 19, it should be noted. 53 on Metacritic. Critics were really divided on this one. I mean, really divided. The bell curve was long and flat. I mean, everyone was all over the place. Todd McCarthy of The Hollywood Reporter was one of the raves, and he was not a lone gunman on this one, but McCarthy opined, quote, sporting a healthy disregard for respectability, Schrader has just gone for it here with a highly focused recklessness that he turns to his creative advantage, end quote. Meanwhile, Dan Gunderman of the Daily News expressed the opposite opinion. He wrote, quote, movie fans might be better off watching a dog actually munch on another dog. Paul Schrader's latest action drama is downright awful, end quote. Corky.
Yeah.
You're the tiebreaker here. As it happens, ooh, you are the vice president. You're in the Senate there. You're breaking the tie. It's 50-50.
Okay.
How are you going to lean? Do you think the Todds must be crazy? Or do you feel that Gunderman is a blunder man?
Well, as my role as president of the Senate, I would have to say to Senator Todd McCarthy, at long last, sir, have you no decency? Have you no shame, sir? A highly focused recklessness that he uses to his disadvantage? No, I don't agree with that at all. I don't think it's highly focused. And if it is, that's not an inherent compliment, especially with what it is focused on when it is a focused film. So I did not like this film.
Interesting.
And I think, yeah.
Wow.
I think Gunderman is...
All right, well,
is,
we're going to have a Gunderman lot to talk about here Wonderman. Because...
the Wonderman. He's...
I will tell you, I had a blast with this movie. I know it's not for everyone's taste, but God damn it, it sure is for my taste. This, to me, is Schrader's Natural Born Killers. And with everything, you know, off-putting and wonderful that implies. And I will tell you, I am a rabid McCarthyist on
this
one. I mean, sign me up. Hey, what did you know and when did you know it, Mr. McDonald? Because this is upsetting. Healthy disregard for respectability, just gone for highly focused recklessness. I was, yes, McCarthyism all the way. Love it. I was on board for the ride from the fucking batshit opening sequence on. I thought it was an absolute riot. And while also like fitting strangely well into the Schrader filmography and the Schrader aesthetic. It's like this pulp Mishima collision of styles and ideas and tones, and it's amazing. And Cage is great. Defoe is even greater. I understand people not liking
bored.
It, but I don't really. You were bored. Are you fucking kidding
so
me? Really?
Bored, man.
How?
I was like,
how? Explain.
Okay. Everything that happens, you see it coming, and it's, you know what's going to happen, and then also. But nothing happens. It's just a bunch of series of these fucking losers hanging out with each other.
Oh, abso-fucking-lutely. We watch the same film and are having
and
completely different
reactions to it. And
it's not
entertaining. That can be entertaining, but that it wasn't entertaining.
I was fully entertained.
I don't agree
by this
that
movie.
Cage was great in this. Defoe was good. He's always really good. He was good. The Diesel guy was a dead space. It was boring. I was so fucking bored.
Oh boy. Wow. All right. Yeah, I was fascinated by it. I feel like it is sort of a parody of crime films, and I feel like the unique twist of this is that everyone is like a really shitty, pathetic version of their archetype. Like all of the archetypes are present, and they're all really pathetic versions of it. Schrader has no interest in glamorizing or romanticizing or making these people likable or making their lifestyle appealing. So yeah, if you're going in thinking, hey, this guy wrote a bunch of Martin Scorsese movies, this guy made American Gigolo, this movie is going to seduce me. No, it is not. There's a subplot in this movie that gets introduced about halfway through about kidnapping a baby. There is no chance, zero chance. And we know it. Everyone knows it. This baby is not going to melt anyone's icy hearts, a la the criminals in Three Godfathers or any other iteration of that story. They don't give a fuck about the baby. They don't give a fuck about anything. They're bad criminals. They're career criminals. This is all they know. And it's just an amazing parody of all of these archetypes. Again, it's Schrader's Natural Born Killers. That's my take.
Yeah, I don't think he had to go into it thinking that it was going to be some kind of redemption or glamorizing of criminals. I don't think Schrader does that. I mean, his, what, Taxi Driver? Like, his biggest hit that he wrote is not about glamorizing a scumbag. It's about showing you a scumbag being a scumbag. Raging Bull, about a scumbag being a scumbag, who reaches great heights, but he's still a scumbag, and he's his own worst enemy. So yeah, I get that that's the people he writes about, and even this he didn't write, you know, but he knows that that's his genre. I could see the story that Eddie Bunker probably wrote, and I could see, and I know Schrader's a talented director. After this, he made First Reformed, one of the best films of the past 10 years.
Yeah, this is right. First Reformed.
So I don't know where that went, but I got to think that some of the instincts in here were the worst adapting a story to film. It tries to be, you say Natural Born Killers, it tries to be Goodfellas with the voiceover and the cuts showing you that what he's talking about. It just did not work for me.
Yeah, but again, I feel like he's really satirizing, parodying it. It's like a punk rock kind of take on it. It's a real just gob of spit right in the... I mean, I haven't read the book. I can assume that a more faithful adaptation would have been much grittier, much more grounded. And that's why, as I always say, fuck faithful adaptations. Give me creative energy bursting at the seams. That's what this movie is. All right, let's get into it. Let's get into it, and then the people can make their decision about who's right. Wink. All right, bonkers from moment one. Like, what even the fuck? What even the fuck, right? I mean, again, you think of this movie is not going to seduce you and bring you in and open up the book and turn the pages
for you. So you saw this as Natural Born Killers. This is Oliver Stone, hyper-colorized of a drug freakout. I'm thinking, like, this is almost Tim Burton.
Right. It is. It really is. I mean, it's just wild. Like, it's hard to describe. It's just the editing, the sound, the images are, like, distorted, or they're garishly colorful, or they're psychedelic. Things are superimposed on other things. Wowie zowie. It just is. It's a fucking lot. And again, I said from the beginning, not for everyone's taste, fully not for everyone's taste. And I bet you can, by the time you get to the title sequence, you can tell if this isn't for your taste. I was just like, holy fuck, what, like, way to start a movie, my God. So let's just break down what's actually happening here. Willem Dafoe is Mad Dog. Mad Dog, and true to his name, my God, yes. This is not like sarcastically calling a large man tiny. No, he is a mad dog. Like, he is a rabid, coke-huffing lunatic. And again, okay, so you think, yeah, right, you know, Tommy from Good, you know, Joe Pesci from Goodfellas, right? No, because Joe Pesci in Goodfellas is like charming in a scary sort of a way. He's funny in a scary sort of way. You can see why people might like to be around him, but also be terrified to be around him. This guy's just terrifying. Just terrifying and strange. There's so many things happening in this scene. TV, ringing phone, there's an answering machine message. He's obviously just coked as shit. He gets a call from a telemarketer who won't let him off the phone. He just wants to, like, talk to him about his life. He says he guts fish. He says his name is John McCain. There's all these Requiem for a Dream. I mean, it's just, we're out of control.
They're playing like sounds from old time radio. Dun, 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 dun,
yeah.
Dun,
dun. Everything's just insane. So now this blonde woman comes home, obviously the owner of the home, and her daughter come home with groceries. They're both kind of larger blonde women, and she's like, oh my God, not you again, get the hell out of here, you're not supposed to be in here, right? So this is obviously like something that has happened over and over and over and over again. It's like, oh shit, here comes the scumbag again. He talks her down, sweet talks her with sex and short ribs. I mean, how's that not work? And it works. It works, by God. So there's just more going on. Suddenly, she's like, throws him out of the room because she found him surfing porn on her laptop.
Cut to some real hardcore images.
Really hardcore. Oh, this movie is, this is the man who directed
it. Yeah, that's true.
For fuck's sake. Like, this movie.
Somewhere George C. Scott was like in his
feet. He's just like, ah. Casket. Suddenly, he just slashes her throat. Just slashes her throat. Jumps on her back and stabs her to death. It's incredibly shocking. It's played for weird laughs. There's these shots of like bobbleheads, that woohoo song, you know, the woohoo, woohoo, that song's playing.
Yeah.
And he's, and it just keeps going, right? He says, your problems are over now, Sheila. Then the daughter sees it. He chases the daughter, grabs a gun, executes the daughter. And then in the aftermath of all this is just a shot of him sitting on the bed, quietly taking a bump of coke while we hear the final message about cupcakes that has been playing this time, this entire time. Title. I was like,
that is a, it's a really intense opening.
It's a get the fuck on with this or don't get on with this. Just like, and again, I do feel that he is, he's satirizing a sort of post-Tarantino type of crime movie.
Hmm.
This kind of thing about like playing these sort of things for laughs, right? This isn't, you know, you think to like Raging Bull and Taxi Driver and, you know, American Jig, the violence isn't played for laughs really ever. He doesn't really go for that. I do think he is kind of satirizing a lot of the archetypes and a lot of the cliches of the kind of crime.
I think that's giving him a pass. I think he just failed at what he was trying to do. Or maybe he didn't fail at it. It was nowhere near what he was, I think, trying to do. Like a Tarantino.
No, not like a Tarantino. Not to do it, but to kind of make fun.
No, I know. That's what you're saying he's doing. I'm saying I think he was more trying to.
Oh, emulate. You're saying there's just nothing. Okay, but like, again, let's go through Paul Schrader's filmography. Where is he like trying to? Doesn't track. All right, moving on. 3 days later. 3 days later. All right. Okay. Fair enough. He was trying to rip off Tarantino and did it poorly. Is that what you're...
Well, I lean more that than saying it's a parody. I never got parody out of this.
Oh wow. Okay. I mean, I full on this entire movie is a parody of crime films, of crime stereotypes.
So take it from your top. When has he ever done a parody?
Oh boy. Good question. Yeah. I mean. Yeah, fair enough. You
could be right, though, because like they took a movie away from him, so he's just like, all right, fuck you. I'm doing the kind of movie you think I'm going to make, and I'm just going to make it balls to the wall.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it feels like an angry movie. It feels like something he had to get out of his system to maybe make this kind of recent spate that he's made that are a little more kind of like, that are much more nuanced, obviously, first of all. Brilliant movie. Fantastic. Card Counter was excellent. I haven't seen Master Gardener yet.
But no, I think right there, what you just said, that was the impression I got. The main thing. This is an angry story. It felt like, who was it that was trying to, oh God, damn it, sorry. Friedkin. Not Friedkin. I don't know. Never mind. Forget it. But I get what you're saying. That totally.
Best.
This was an angry person. It was someone we just reviewed. Someone was like, the Vampire's Kiss guy. It was like they're in a dark place.
Sure.
They have an axe to grind.
Dark place. Well, and another movie I liked a hell of a lot more than you did, I think. So I don't know. Hey, give me an axe to grind. I love it. All right. So 3 days later. So we go to the title, which is just like, boom, holy fuck. This guy who have not been introduced just killed two innocent people, including a child. 3 days later, I laughed. I'm like, really? Just 3 days later? All right. Now, okay. So if you've ever seen, you know, Mishima, which is one of the great Paul Schrader movies, that whole film, it vacillates between like these very beautiful black and white kind of biopic scenes and then these adaptations of plays that are heavily stylized. They're in Technicolor. This movie is doing that the entire time. Again, it's a Natural Born Killers kind of aesthetic of one scene, it is a silky black and white. The next scene, it is gorgeous Technicolor. Mm. The next scene, it is handheld camera and it's gritty and it's ugly. We're really just like whatever's working for the scene, we're going for it. You feel like I felt like a real creative energy kind of coming through this movie. So now it's this black and white. We're getting introduced to Nicolas Cage's character. It's this like dreamy tracking shot in the strip club and the camera. I mean, Schrader's so great at moving the camera and doing all that kind of stuff. Cage is there. He's in a suit, and we have the scene of him like introducing the gang, right? So again, like, admittedly, there's a lot of cliches here. This is Troy. He's the leader, but Danny Ocean, the dude, is not.
Danny Lane is
like, again, everyone here is like a fucked up version of their archetype. He's the fucked up version of the slick mastermind. Mad Dog is the fucked up version of the squirrely henchman, and Diesel is the fucked up version of like the big guy, the big bruiser. Yeah. And also the brains in a sort of a backward
way. We'll come back to that.
So flashbacks. They, you know, this is another thing. Poop, poop, poop. We're flipping all around. You know, someone says something, it goes to a flashback. They met in prison. Mad Dog basically killed someone for Troy. Didn't even think about it. What a guy.
Killed some Aryan Brotherhood guys who were going to rape Troy in the shower. Yeah. And it's all, this is where I say it was doing Goodfellas, because it's like the opening of Goodfellas, where it's giving you all the flashback and story while he's narrating and telling you what's happening. But you're seeing it more than you're hearing it. They work together hand in hand. That's what's happening.
Yeah. So Troy, they were all in prison. Troy's the last one out. This is the gang. This is his welcome home party. I don't know, maybe you're right, because like there are all these sort of like, there's a lot of like the Tarantino style, let's have a banal conversation in between these like bursts of like crazy violence, right? So it's very Tarantino-esque. But again, I think it kind of goes with everything's a fucked up version of itself, in that the conversations are like beyond banal, like so banal and pathetic, right? There's a conversation kind of coming later from this where there's a drug dealer who is like in the car and he's talking while they're trailing him. And he's like talking about his girlfriend. He's like, yeah, that bitch, my bitch, bitch. You know, he's talking about it in like a drug dealer. But what he's actually talking about is how she doesn't respect him and she never gives him credit. Like, he's whining. Like, he's just like, everyone is here so pathetic and so weak and so self-deluded about who they are and where they are in the world. They kind of talk about how they're all behind the times because they don't know who Taylor Swift is. They didn't know that the America invaded Iraq or anything like that. And there isn't here this one just shot of that, like they took him out to get a suit or something like that, this blue suit that he's wearing. And it cuts to this like just 2 second shot of like Cage adjusting the suit in the mirror, which it was little touches like that that make me feel like, yeah, I'm on.
I gotcha.
He knows what he's doing. All right, so this is the gang, and so now we go to the job, right? So we're going to connect with an old contact, El Greco, and this is Schrader. Okay, it's Paul Schrader doing interesting work here. There's lots of uhs and ums. I guess, so it's very natural. He's fine.
It felt like he definitely wanted to play himself put himself in as another scumbag. Like, I want to say racist things. I want to demean everybody. I want to be the mastermind who puts people together for connections. He wants to be Lawrence Tierney from Reservoir Dogs.
Yes, absolutely. Good call. So we hear the job described, but everything is so like kind of weirdly like alighted or sort of obscure, right? Like, but we sort of get the idea that it's this attorney, like a, what do you call like a family attorney or like a criminal's attorney, you know, like a Better Call Saul type of guy, you know, like a guy who really, you
like,
know,
is it like Tom Regan
makes no like people who make money off of like representing drug dealers.
Oh, like a storefront lawyer.
Yeah. Or who the Sopranos lawyer would be. You know what I mean? Like one of those kind of crime lawyer, but
a criminal lawyer
for criminals. And he wants to, this guy's scheme is, I mean, we don't actually meet him, we see one shot, but his scheme is to like rip off a client, which is this drug dealer named Moon Man. And I mean, that's all we really get, you know what I mean? Like Greco, you know, he hears about Mad Dog, he's not so sure about Mad Dog, but he's still, they're going to go along with the job. I mean, I just think it's interesting because like this attorney who is apparently pulling the shots on this entire thing. We don't even meet the guy. It's just like there's so many levels down. You know, they're not, it's like, they're really not, they're very low.
No, level, yeah, and I can appreciate
guys
that.
For their braggadocio.
Like, for criminals, this is the way they would talk. They wouldn't belabor points. They wouldn't offer very, you know, deep thoughts on things. And you don't want to know who you don't need to know. It's all insulation against getting jammed up. So I get all that.
Absolutely.
But just a little bit of why, what, I don't know.
No, well, I mean, what, yeah, I'm,
I don't know.
I'm curious what you felt was,
because
was,
like you say,
was
it,
lacking.
It was hard to differentiate between what's a banal conversation and what's
sure.
the plan for the plot of the movie, mm-hmm. between what's the next scene. Is it a tense situation or is it tense in the banal situation, right? We get all of that.
So they get these cop uniforms and they get cop cars. They follow. They're on the job now, right? They go right out to the job. It's not
my first laugh though. When they're like, "Can you get us police uniforms?" And Schrader's like, "Yeah, I can get you that." And then they show like there's a pin across the cop car, and it's got just like tape at different angles, and it says "police" all offset. It like would not hold up to any amount of scrutiny.
No, no. But they follow Moon Man, who has this very, like I say, his bodyguard is utterly useless. They take him away, say it's a parking tickets, but they break his nose and they say, you know, take me to your trap house or take us to your trap house. So this is it. They're just like, the attorney wants to rip off this guy. He just doesn't know like where it is. And so they have him take him to this place. But it very quickly, as all their jobs do, just goes wrong. Yeah. Very quickly, attention spilling. All the residents realize, oh, these guys aren't cops. This is very fake. They don't find the money. They're supposed to find money. They do find drugs, just like pure luck, right? They just like pull out a drawer or something like that. And gunshots start coming in, and they flee and they make it off. Boom.
Right.
That's it. That's their big score. Yeah. Like, and they have a big
party this part,
to celebrate.
It's in the seediest. It's supposed to be like, all right, we're celebrating, but it's in the seediest like motel. One bed motel, and it's these three men, two of them in their 60s, like mid to late 60s, doing coke off each other, drinking.
Yep.
I mean, the folks shoots up too, so I don't know what all he's on. The only thing they didn't do was throw the money up in the air and jump on the bed on it, you know?
Right.
I was just like, come on, you're in your 60s. This isn't. This is just. I get it if you're in your 20s, 30s, whatever. Anyway.
But no, that's why I think, I mean, it is so pathetic because, like, they didn't do the job, right? They did sort of part of, like, a half, two-thirds of the job. And, like, when Cage comes back, he's like, yeah, I talked him into giving us $10,000.
Yeah.
You know, that's like $3,000 each. Or I spent $300 on some blow and some, you know, whiskey or whatever. But... so then they all go out and they each have what I would call a rough night with the ladies. All three in a very different way have a rough night with the ladies. So we first go to Troy, this Cage's character, who has a high class, beautiful blonde prostitute there, very eager to get $300 to go down
with him.
And he just will not stop talking. Not in a motor mouth, like Mad Dog sort of way, but just in a like, have you ever been to Nice?
Right.
You know, oh yeah, I flew there one time. He starts talking about this particular type of jewelry. Like she's just like, please, 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 $300 to suck your cock. And he just like wants to have a conversation.
He wants a
like
date.
They're out getting coffee on a first date. Yes. He wants a date. Cut to Mad Dog having a slightly different kind of an evening, which he's getting a hand job from the hotel maid, who is so bored she starts checking her phone. And then probably the most interesting one, which is Diesel.
Yeah.
Diesel sort of gets picked up by this girl in a bar, or he sort of picks her up.
Well, she's a call girl. It was like the most natural of, if anybody's the most well-adjusted to talk to people, he is. It seems that way.
Yes. He's the closest. She's talking about Elliot Smith and how Elliot Smith's suicide wasn't real. And there's just, she's having this conversation and kind of querying him about it. He like freaks out. He like gets really angry.
It happens in two spaces, right? They have the bar conversation, which causes them to go up to the motel. But this is where I was just like, Diesel is described as the muscle. He's a huge hulking guy, but also he's the smartest of them all somehow. He's not the plan man, mm-hmm. but he's the smartest of them all. Like, in another world, he could have been a lawyer, but this isn't another world, that kind of thing. However, the way that's shown in this movie is just that he knows like random facts. Like, he knows bar trivia right. about like, right. he has yes. this whole thing about why the bartender gives him ice cubes in his glass. And that
yes. Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, he could be the smartest one, but in that group, it's just knowing bar trivia.
No, absolutely. So it's an interesting scene because he freaks out. She freaks right. out. He's getting really mad. He's a very large man. She's
alone in a room with him.
She's like, I'm out of here. She takes off. He goes after her. So, you know, I'm feeling not super good for this. She says herself, I don't feel safe. It's a very, very tense scene. But he actually, like, walks away and seems to feel bad.
Yeah, so...
I maybe not feel bad about making her specifically feel unsafe, but about how what that says
he
about
knows
him
his behavior.
Like, as a person.
Yes.
He knows, yeah, like, this is who he is. Everyone's going to... That's right on the surface there. He's a very giant...
Right,
man.
And we didn't say, we did, but Willem Dafoe kicks his girl out. He, Diesel basically chased and threatened his girl out of there. Anything can go pie-eyed with these guys like that. Like, and does.
Absolutely. And yet, breakfast the next day, they're still trying to, like, rally themselves. And he's like talking about the next job. The next job's going to be Hughes. He said, Cage just suddenly says, I'll get us such a good gig. Take a tits off. And they're like, yeah. And then they're all like,
yeah. It lingers on them.
It's a sad scene.
I did like that. It lingers on them.
And it also lingers on in the background. I don't know if you see in the foreground, somebody with like an oxygen mask is sitting there. This is not a high class joint that they are at. It is very.
It reminded me of Midnight Run. When the bail bondsman goes across the street to always use the phone, it's like you think he's going over to a restaurant. No, it's like some like dirty alley, open air restaurant that he uses the phone at.
Yeah. Okay. So now, all right, that was the first job. Setting up the next job. Troy is a little even more squirrely this time. Troy his grasp on reality is getting a little tenuous. He keeps doing this Bogart impression, a really bad Bogart impression.
I didn't notice him doing it until the end.
He does it a little bit here and there, and then he
talks
about it a lot. He's like, oh, you love those movies, Bogart and Eddie G? So the next job, they're setting it up. The plan now is to kidnap a one-year-old baby to force the dad to pay millions that he owes some guy.
Who has
and
no time for Nicolas Cage. Like, Nicolas Cage imagines himself a big wheel. This guy is like, you are not in my league. I'm barely acknowledging you at this table. He does his, oh, you're right. He does his Eddie G impersonation.
Yeah.
Well, so anyway.
And the money, I mean, this is like reprehensible, but the money keeps going up and up and up and up and up and up. And Troy is like, goes and he sells his guys on this job, this big job, but with the caveat that it's either win or die. There's no jail. There's no going to the station and ratting on the other guys. He says, it's got to be samurai style. And Bad Dog says, Jackie Chan. One of the best fucking lines. Jackie fucking Chan, and it's not even acknowledged. It's great. All right, and now we're boom. Here we go. We're on the day of the crime, right?
Yeah.
But we don't follow the criminals. Who do we follow? Some guy on his phone, driving there. This is actually the target.
Another piece of shit.
This is the target. He is going. To the house. So the plan
is talking to like his wife about going to his baby mama house.
Yeah.
To beat up her boyfriend.
Yeah.
Like, who? These people do not live in a world that you and I are familiar with.
No.
And this guy is like 10 years older than us.
Right. Yeah. So he drives to the house and he's waiting there. He's kind of laying in wait, but not for them, for somebody else who he thinks is coming in. They think the house is going to be just the nanny and the baby and
the mom.
It.
That's what they were told.
And they're actually, they enter, yeah, they enter while he's sleeping down. He's, it's like they're so long he falls asleep. They enter while he's downstairs and they're in the nursery with the baby and the nanny. This guy walks in with a gun, and says, "You're so fucked." I don't know why he thought that, because Mad Dog blows his head clean the fuck off. I mean, it is really gory. It is very, it is, all of the deaths are pretty bloodily.
That done. Baby? That baby is deaf.
No
reason. The shotgun off 2 feet from its crib.
Right in front of it. Everyone's just shocked. Holy fuck, this guy doesn't have a head. They search him. They don't know who the fuck is this guy. They think maybe he's one of this guy's, like, kind of, you know, henchmen or something like that.
They find an ID that is a Mexican name.
Yeah. So it's all just gone fucking cocked up. I mean, it's just, it's a complete disaster. But
they're still just cool about it. Like, they're still going to take this baby.
We're doing the job. We still are doing the job. Nothing's changed.
There's no, like, impulse of being delicate or gentle with the baby. It's like, here, give it to the nanny. Force the nanny to take care of it. There was this point where he goes, "What do you put in the baby's mouth to get it to shut up?" And one of the fun was, "Dick." And Nick Cage has to, like, go, "No, that's not it."
Like, no.
There's no acknowledgement of how inappropriate.
No. No. Oh, wow. Yeah. So, yeah, they now split up. Mad Dog and Diesel, they take the baby and the nanny and the body. Troy waits at home for the mother. I don't know why he waited home. It does not go well. No. He gets impatient because she won't listen to him, and it's implied that he kills her.
It's off. They do an outside establishing shot, gun noise. Maybe added later because they never realized that they didn't show the mom disappearing.
Right.
This is the part where I was just like, okay, this makes no fucking sense. Why do they care about getting rid of this body?
Right.
They take great pains to clean up, wrap the body up, and then travel with it. Like, okay, if you're saying that these are, it's just about stumbling, bumbling criminals, okay. But even they would have the self protection to not travel with a dead body in their car. They all have two strikes.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the movie seems to imply they don't really have a lot of instinct for self-protection. They're not very good at it. Like, their instincts are to commit crime and try to cover it up and get away with it. You know what I mean? I just feel like the movie, especially in these the kind of opening scenes that we didn't talk too much about, the kind of strip club, that once you're in, you're in, right? Like, you get out of prison, but it's just, you're marking time until you're going to get back in, because what are you going to do? The option is, get that shitty, you know, minimum wage job and report to your parole officer every week, or go out and make a living. Just, I really feel it's just about, you know, and Eddie Bunker, I'm sort of assuming here, but Eddie Bunker being somebody who was a criminal since a very young age, I do feel like he has that, the movie is about that criminal mentality of, like, keep going forward, keep going forward, keep going forward. Don't think about it. Like, we're just keep going and going, and you're just, meet in the grinder.
No, and I get that. I get that. I just,
it's an incredibly
taking the body with you is the worst part. Like, I get to take the baby, to whatever.
Oh, it's all the worst part though, really, because, like, well, why wait behind for the mom just to shoot her? Like, what was the point of that? Like, okay, like, the information to get out, which was, like,
now there's more
tell your, like, well, and then. Wasn't her the point of telling her so that she would tell the guy who was going to pay the ransom in the first place? Again, they don't think about these fucking things. So the nanny and the baby, again, great plan. Stash them in a locked house with a phone. But don't call. We'll call you. We never hear anything about the baby or the nanny. That's it. And, like, if you thought the baby was going to be, like, a key point, it's just, like, the baby's there just to show how little of a fuck they give a fuck about anything. They don't even think about it. It's not even, like, they don't have that twinge of, like, ooh, that you and I would have. Like, the twinge is, like, ooh, 25 years to life.
Yeah.
You know? Like, that's the twinge. Troy lies on the phone. He says the wife didn't show up. He's talking to Greco. No. And Greco lets him know, hey, genius, you killed the guy who was going to pay the ransom. Like, how's that going to work? And he says, like, this guy's going to be pissed. I'll see if I can still get some money off of that. Like, it's like they think to the very end, they're still going, you have fucked up this job. You're the, kidnapped the baby. That was the goal. All right, you did that. But then you shot the dude who was going to pay you and shot the baby's mom. And where's the fucking baby? Where's the baby, right? Like, it's just all completely fucked up. But they still think, like, I think we can still get some money out of this. All right, so now we're splitting up again because Mad Dog and Diesel, they're going to dump the body. But Mad Dog needs that strip club coke bump. And a little heart to heart. We haven't heard anything about, remember poor Sheila from the
3 days ago?
We haven't heard... Oh, 3 days? Why? It's probably like, maybe it's 5 days at this point. He unburdens his heart to Diesel. To Diesel. They're starting the strip club, and then they're on the road. He tells them, you know, yeah, I killed her. I killed her daughter. And he's more afraid that, like, Diesel will, like, tell Troy because he's jealous of their relationship. Mad Dog is just, I mean... They call him paranoid. He's obviously very paranoid, but also his insecurity and his self-loathing are just like so out of control. But he is insistent on his ability to improve. Yeah. He wants to put a period on that point in his life by dumping their body at the same place he dumped Sheila's, which is like several hours out of town. Then embarking on a plan of self-improvement with Diesel's guidance. Like this, like, what the fuck? Insane. But Diesel, yeah, I'll do it, man. Pledges his help. They shake on the deal. They get to this place, which is disgusting. Yeah. They're dragging this body. It's just this completely corpses and garbage and medical waste fucking... everywhere. Defoe is just coke motor mouthing the entire time, completely driving Diesel crazy. He actually at one point describes an organism that is structurally bent on their own self-destruction, which I think kind of encapsulates these characters.
And this was my only point of attention to me in this movie.
Oh yeah,
because I know what's gonna happen. You can see it coming,
right?
And the camera stays on Defoe, who is ahead of Diesel, carrying his body up these stairs. So you're just waiting for the shot to come from off camera, something to come from off camera to put Defoe out, because you know that's what's coming. So I was feeling that tension.
But that's not actually what
happens. No, it's not what happens. Again.
Which is kind of interesting. It keeps going. It goes on longer than you would think. They keep lugging. He keeps talking. He's like, I want you to tell me five things, five character defects that I can fix. Yeah. You know, like he's still on this whole plan. They get up to the, like his corpse attic. Right. I don't know where the fuck they are. They climb up to this structure. It collapses. Yeah. They all fall down in a heap of syringes and corpses. Yeah. Mad Dog does not skip a beat. He is still just like, yeah. And so I'm going to really stick to this plan. I'm going to really stick to this plan. You get like, he's still going. This was my question was like, did Diesel plan to kill him the entire time, or was it just like, was the corpse attic collapsing like that little bit of over the edge that he was like, all right, you know what? No, what am I thinking?
I think it was, and that's why, I mean, but I felt like it was set up obviously to be that way.
Yeah.
Like you're supposed to think that that's going to happen, and then you're seeing, okay, maybe it's not going to happen. And then like everything, random circumstance happens. Like that guy just showing back up at that house waiting for them. The wife coming home after, you know, just random circumstance happens and they react poorly to it. Whether you want to say him killing Mad Dog poor behavior or not, or like the betterment of society. But yeah, I think that was the thing that put him over, that actually being face to face, like gore and blood and the faces of the dead. Like,
wow, there are a lot of dead bodies up here. Yeah, there's so many dead bodies. The roof can't collapse on us. Yeah. So Diesel calls Troy, just says something happened. And instantly Troy knows. And it's just...
Well, flashbacks to their hotel from Barbie.
Yes, we were a family. And what I love is that, like, when they go to the hotel room, they're having a ketchup and mustard pie. They are squirting ketchup and mustard at each other. Oh, fuck. All right, sorry. So trust is eroding. Trust's eroding into the group, right? All these, they were going to stick together forever, but also, you know, it was win or die. Now it seems to be maybe every man for himself. But now Diesel and Troy are in the car together. Troy, again, is still saying that Troy is simultaneously saying, we might still get some money for this complete fuck up, but also we need to go on the run and hide. Right. Right, like it's okay, Troy. You know, like they're not really.
Good plan, man.
Yeah, woof. Good plan, buddy. Diesel needs to go to the store. Troy waits in the car. He's actually reading a GQ with Taylor Swift on the cover, which was kind of funny. Diesel's in the just you know buying some meat. But the supermarket manager sees the gun in his waistband. Sees. Diesel. Again, this is profile.
Yeah, but this is Ohio.
We talked about this.
That guy's seen five guns that day.
That's right. That's... yeah. But it's, again, it's the profiling of like, oh, it's Diesel. It's a scary guy. Now, he really is a scary guy, right? Because he just killed one of his best friends. But it's kind of like when he goes to the cops, they're like, does he do anything? He's like, no, but he's a really scary looking guy. You know, like, I don't want a scary looking guy with a gun in my store. So the cops come on the scene. One's in the store. One pulls Cage out of the car. Troy, again, the tension kind of building up. What's going to happen? Troy punches her. There's this fight. The other cop comes in because he was just leaving the store. Diesel then comes out of the store, shoots the female officer and runs. And everything now is just crazy. More cops on the scene. Diesel shoots some more cops. He takes one of the cars.
I hated this chase scene.
It's not. I mean, the lack of budget.
I think really, that was it. It was the slowest.
Really comes out here.
Chase.
It's very slow and strange, and they obviously were not budgeted for a car crash, because they just you know turn the camera and the actor playing Diesel just goes, oh, you know. So, implied death. Yeah. While Troy is taken into custody.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. This. I mean. As much as I did love this movie from like the energy level and the creative level, it's obvious that like the low budget, you know, kind of undermined some of the stuff that they probably wanted to do. But I think also that maybe just gave it more free rein to just be like, you know, low fucking stakes. We can do whatever the fuck we want. You know, we want this scene to be in black and white. I want it to be like this. I want to shoot like this, whatever. So that's part of, I think, why I did love this movie so much. But back to Troy. In the back of the cop car, cops are taking him out somewhere. It's not looking good.
No, this is not. This is not a good end.
We got a cop killer in the car. We are driving out into some kind of industrial abandoned area, and they pull him out. They beat the shit out of him, and they hook his handcuff to the door of the car and just drag him along. And that sure seems to be the end of Troy.
Until
cut to black, we have waking from a dream type noises. Waking from a dream, and here is this old, like a century old diner. You know, this like really old kind of one of those little diners. It's in black and white. It's this dreamy shot. It turns to color. Now there's these kind of like panning and tracking shots and. TV news is on. It confirms that Troy and Diesel are both dead. There's this old black couple that, like, where in the fuck are we going with this? This old black couple's in the diner. They leave the diner. Oh, that was so nice. What a good one. Yeah, okay, let's go home. They get in their car, but oof, Troy leaps out of the bushes, abducts him, now doing a full-on terrible Bogart impression. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's really more of an Edward G. Robinson kind of thing, but he's just like, Shay, I got the drop on you, you know.
I tell you like this, you're going to be square.
Yes, doing all the hard-boiled language, and he explains what happened, which is nonsense. Yeah. It's complete nonsense, right? He even is like, I'll drive. You guys want to sit in the back? Like, he drives, okay? Now we're driving into the fog. It's getting even kind of more dreamy and surreal. There's colorful lights. There's sirens. His eyes in the rearview mirror. We're getting these really kind of intense tensely framed shots. Spirituals are playing on the cassette player. He gets out of the car. He's surrounded by cops. He could give up. He could give up right here. Avoid a bloodbath. But remember, samurai style, Jackie Chan. He's making eyes with a black couple, too. Her like, what the fuck are you doing? Pulls out a gun, starts firing. This couple just gets, they are Bonnie and Clyde. They get absolutely mowed
Bolivian
down.
Army outside.
Yes.
Which
they get really brutally killed. Troy hits a couple of cops. He finally goes down. It's just this crazily stylized finale. And again, if following Schrader's career, this is like a very common thing for him, is like obviously self-destructive men, people who live outside of society, culminating in this, you know, cathartic act of violence that may be real, may be a fantasy, maybe a dream, you know,
still
like
with a voiceover.
Taxi Driver, fucking First Reformed, you know, like so many of these movies. He goes down and we get his closing narration, which is nonsense. I'll read it for you. Justice. That was what I wanted. Then I started thinking, I didn't want justice. I just wanted what I wanted, just like everyone, and the rest of it was verbiage. Boom, the end. Kablamo, that's your movie. Corky McDonald, you know, as will happen sometimes, two people can watch the same film, see every frame, hear every word, see all the same things, right? And interpret it in a completely different way. Have a completely different experience. This has happened. It happened before. It'll happen.
Yeah. I think that no better summation of Nicolas Cage as a performer, as an actor, exists. Two people can watch him do his thing. And I don't even think this movie is that big of an example of it, but I'm just saying over the course of his career, two people can watch him do the same thing. Some people will call him America's greatest living actor, and other people are just like, is he even good? I don't know, you know?
Yeah. Maybe it's like a Rorschach.
Well, that's why they call him Paul Rorschach Schrader. Because... didn't quite stick that one, sorry.
But I have to say, I really liked Cage in this one. Again, because he's doing something very interesting here. It starts out at the beginning when he's introduced, I thought, okay, we're doing kind of regular guy Cage, or we're doing leading man Cage, right? But over the course of the film, it really kind of like transforms into weirdo Cage, right? Like it keeps getting weirder.
Yeah, he's
weird
with that
housekeeper.
It's just,
right? And like I said, like his first sit down with El Greco, which is like pretty smooth and very professional, versus his second sit down with El Greco and the other guy, he is being very weird. He's doing voices. He's acting strange, you know. It's just like this hole that he's just going down. And I don't know, maybe it's just in that first scene, he is clean. Mm. He is just out of prison. He is crisp. He is pressed and ironed. And the longer he's out, the just more just kind of disconnected he gets from any kind
there
of
was,
movie, you know, I just
there was a visual cue that kind of lends to what you're saying. His style of clothes and his hair get more dingier and messed up as the movie goes. The more everything's falling apart around him.
Yeah. So a good chance for him to do his leading man thing, but also to make some very strange choices, including the quote unquote Bogart accent and all the claims that people think he looks just like Bogart and all this other stuff in the movie. Oh, it's pretty wild, but I'm glad we talked about it. I'm glad we talked it out. I respect your opinion. I don't agree with your opinion, but I did say at the very beginning, this is not a movie for all tastes, and I know it. But it's a movie for my taste. And I think if you like that aesthetic, if you like the Schrader's whole bag, and you were thinking, I'm never going to watch this. And if you're a Schrader acolyte, but you thought, I don't want to watch a fucking straight-to-video movie he did with Nick Cage, I'm saying give it a chance. I'm saying give it a chance. You might have a blast. I sure as shit did.
I would say if you like something like this, if you want to see some, No Sudden Move.
Ah, okay. So
yeah. It's a good, taut, Things go wrong, can't plan for things, criminals being criminals, not existing outside of their realm, and how their intertwined lives and fuck-ups meet.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, it's a different take on very similar material for sure. But also, again, I think from an auteur's perspective, you know, No Sudden Moves, a very Soderbergh-ian film, like it's very cerebral and it's kind of stylized in a very kind of a subtler way, whereas Schrader, just the balls to wallness of this thing is.
But I don't feel like
it captivated.
I don't feel like the direction outside of that first 5 minutes, whatever it was, the opening scene with Defoe, that was balls to the wall. Maybe that's just
No, you can't do that.
No,
the whole
you
movie,
can't.
But
so you can't be Natural Born Killers the whole movie, right? You do it there. There are touches later on, like, and I think I will give credit to what you said about the different choices in shots, styles, handheld, static cam, that kind of stuff, lent to the whatever works for that moment, which is kind of leans into the whole ethos of these guys. Whatever I need to get by right now, I'm doing.
Yeah, there it is.
I get that. But I felt like some of the choices afterwards were kind of boring. Like, and especially towards the end, especially like anything that had to be, why even go big on the car chase type thing? You know, the CGI glass and stuff. It just looked more hokey. And I didn't get the even the scene where, like I'm saying, the one I felt like most tense, where they're climbing up the stairs with that. That was good. That was really well done. But then when they fall into the body, I don't feel the impact of why Diesel went there. You know. It's just a lot of close-ups of him slipping on body parts, and it's not really like the horror. Right. Like,
yeah,
pay
yeah.
some of that off to me, you know.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, again, not everything lands. It is a pretty low-budget film. It doesn't all work. However, so much of it worked for me that I'm giving it a full recommendation. Definitely one of the best movies we've
I'm watched. Glad, regardless of what I felt, I'm glad you found one that you liked a lot.
Took me long.
All right, so that's all we have for you on this episode of Dare Daniel Cage Match. But we'll be back in 2 weeks to close out the season with another review of a Nicolas Cage movie, along with a preview of some other projects we have in the works.
Ooh, it's a surprise. Don't freak out. Don't be a cage. Until then, be sure to follow Dare Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. We collectively call them the Schmied. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app if you want to support the show. If you want to support the show, visit daredaniel.com, find the donate button, or click support the show in the menu. Should take you right there. So for Dare Daniel, I'm who else? Daniel Barnes.
And I'm Quirk McDonald saying, regardless what Dan would lead you to believe, McCarthyism was awful for the country. Dan's a staunch McCarthyite.
Oh, yeah.
Big time.
Todd McCarthyite. Todd. The Todds must be fucking awesome.
Todd Stabler. See you guys.
All right. Bye-bye.